Welcome to Madrid Live with Anne Bateson in the hot seat on Radio Círculo at the Círculo de Bellas Artes in Madrid. Emails to info@madridlive.fm. In this week's show, we feature one of the world's greatest war photographers, the Englishman Don McCullen, who's just been awarded a knighthood for his services to photography. He's also just published a set of books called Irreconcilable Truths, which look back over his life and work. Now, an exhibition of McCullen's work was on show in Madrid a few years ago, and it featured some of the most iconic images of war, from Cambodia to Biafra, and from Beirut to Vietnam. McCullen took me around the exhibition, and you can hear that interview in this show. Music by British artists features big in today's show too. We kick off with The Clash and London Calling. That was The Clash with London Calling. London Calling. Calling London, which is where the war photographer Don McCullen hails from. McCullen's just been awarded a knighthood for his services to photography. And he says that this marks a huge journey from his poor and impoverished beginnings in North London. Now, McCullen's just published a set of books called Irreconcilable Truths, which look back over his life and work. The books contain over 700 photos, and in fact, a lot of those photos were also featured in an exhibition of his work in Madrid a few years ago. And I went along to the opening of the exhibition, and I asked Don why he became a photographer.
Downstairs in this exhibition, there's a picture of a gang of boys, which I took in 1958 at the bottom of my street, which is in North London, a place called Finsbury Park. Some of the boys in the pictures have criminal records now, one actually for armed robbery. But prior to the picture being published, the boys were involved in a gang war with another bunch of boys from North London, and a policeman tried to intervene in this brawl in the High Street in Holloway Road and was knifed in the back and died. The man who killed him, who came from Islington, surrendered himself to the police but was subsequently hung because it was a really serious capital offence to kill a policeman in 1958. So really, you could say I started my life as a photographer from the beginning on violence.
You took a photo of that situation, you're saying?
I didn't photograph the fight because it took place at night. I photographed one of the gangs of boys that were involved in it because I went to school with them. So they allowed me to photograph them, and then I asked their permission whether I could publish it in the Observer newspaper, and they were full of it and said, yeah, of course, you know, they were really, it was all about bravado. And the very Sunday morning, the picture was published in the newspaper alongside some others of the same group. The following day, the telephone where I worked in London in a little studio was ringing from all kinds of powerful organisations offering me a contract to work for them. And unfortunately, I declined all of the offers because I really wasn't a photographer. This was almost done in an amateur way. So I had to quickly learn about photojournalism.
And how did you do that?
I bought books and magazines and, you know, basically I'm self-taught because, you know, I left school at 15 and I couldn't read. And if I hadn't have discovered photography, I would have possibly fallen in with this group of boys. Subsequently, I would have almost surely wound up in prison, you see.
An amazing story. What about your influences? Other photographers, for example?
Oh, well, of course, when I was scuttling around looking for the answers to my questions, you know, what is photography, what is photojournalism, I one day discovered a group of books in an antique shop in Cornwall, and they were about photography as beginnings in 1886. And, you know, photography in 1886 was only 30 odd years old, so I was then looking at the masters of photography who flourished about the turn of the century, and they were people like Edward Steich and Alfred Stieglitz. I was very strongly influenced by them, and then later on I started discovering the work of a man called Bill Brandt, and there were others, many others, and so once I acquired this knowledge and I acquired a lot more self-confidence, I started to grow in my own style as a photographer.
How would you describe that style?
Dark, very dark and foreboding, and very intense, my work. I'm intense when I'm engaged in photography because I possibly take myself too serious, but one of the things I try to avoid is flaws in my work. I try to present excellence. I try to present my own style. Most photographers are a combination of other people they've admired, you know. It's the way painters would have looked at other painters' work. And by the way, let me emphasize that I no way associate myself with the art world. You know, photography has now been upgraded, and people call you artist and things like that. I totally, you know, refute that, and I'm a serious photographer. I'm certainly not a fine artist. I don't believe in it.
You mentioned Bill Brandt. I understand Bill Brandt was famous for taking photographs of the north of England, and here in your exhibition there are photos of the north of England. Do you think he influenced you in that way?
Very much so, yes. And the thing about Bill Brandt was that because he came from quite a strange background, obviously from a German background, that also in the Brandt family there was a banking side of it, so there was money. And what was strange about him was that he surrendered the comforts of that life on occasions and went to the north of England and photographed miners being scrubbed in the bathtub in front of the fire by their wives. So, and also his satanic darkness of his pictures and the printing of them very much influenced me, and many people accuse me of printing my pictures too dark. But of course, one has to remember that Brandt didn't indulge his photography into the war. So he wouldn't have come up against the real tragic emotions of the pain and suffering that war, you know, dumps on civilians and people. So even though his darkness was like all of our own darkness, we are persuaded by our feelings and things we've seen. Brandt wouldn't have seen that. But I've seen the worst possible things you can see that humanity indulges in. So therefore I can equate the reasons for my darkness. But I have to arrest that, because now I've broken away from war photography because of my age and my lack of interest in looking at other people's suffering anymore. I'm photographing the English landscape quite a lot, but again, I only choose to do it when it's winter, when the landscape is naked and stripped of leaves and foliage, and therefore people equate my landscapes now with some brooding war kind of memories, you know. They think I'm turning my landscapes into war scenes of destruction.
Is that perhaps because you work in black and white?
Partly that, but partly because I induce a lot more black and white into it. It's not about contamination, it's about drama, really. I try to bring drama into my work by heightening the contrast and, you know, making things slightly threatening. So therefore, you know, the one thing about me is that when I take a picture, I do not want you to walk past it without noticing it. I try to arrest you. And in the case of the war pictures, I try to arrest you in the most subtle way, because normally one associates war pictures with atrocities. You know, if you look at the straightforward atrocity picture, you discard it immediately because it's unbearable. But I have a way, I think I have a way, of bringing you in and making the viewer want explanation. So in a way, they'll hang around a bit longer in front of these pictures than they would probably normally consider doing so.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of these pictures. Can you describe this one, please, Don?
I think this one's worth looking at because the war in Cambodia started to erupt around about 1970. So I used to work at the Sunday Times in the colour magazine. I proposed that the war in Cambodia was beginning to kick off and that we should be doing something about it. And the editor said, right, we'll go then. So I went. And when I got there, you could hear the gunfire in the distance from the city of Phnom Penh, the really centre of the city. And a friend of mine said to me, I think there's going to be some trouble brewing in such a part of the outskirts of the city. I'll drop you down there and I'll come back in a couple of hours and pick you up. So when he came back, I was actually lying in this truck because I'd been hit with a shell, the same shell that hit this man in the picture, who's seconds away from death. He's sitting up and protesting about the agony that he's suffering. Most of his intestines were destroyed, and so I was wounded in the legs, and my ears were smashed with them. Yeah. So I thought, well, to take my mind off the pain and the situation, I was in very big shock, and I thought, I'll take pictures. So I propped myself up against the wall and photographed this man who died in front of me. By the way, it's getting towards evening, so there's a kind of darkness, a natural darkness coming, and we're in an army lorry going back to the centre of town to the hospital. So by the time we got back to the hospital, I lie down because I was really swimming around with shock and, you know, all kinds of thoughts. And he was lying down, but I noticed his bare feet were by my face and they were moving backwards and forwards because he was dead. It was a big day and a big night for me that night, and it was the beginning of me surrendering some of my own blood, which is quite a good idea, really, because it wasn't life-threatening, and also it gave me an insight how other people felt when they were injured.
Is that why you say it's a good idea, so you could feel how they could feel?
Well, I didn't think it's okay for me to keep leaning over other people dying and being wounded. It didn't teach me any lessons, but it taught me, you know, what it feels like to be injured and in big shock and deaf and, you know, stuff like that. So that was the first time it happened to me.
Going back to this photo, you said this man was going to die minutes later. How do you feel about documenting that?
Of course I feel naturally sad that he died. It was either him or me, and it doesn't make any difference to me. I mean, by that, he sadly died and I survived. You know, how much can you go on punishing yourself about something that happened 35 years ago?
That was the British war photographer Don McCullin. And this is Anne Bateson bringing you Madrid Live on Radio Círculo at the Círculo de Bellas Artes in Madrid. We'll hear more from Don McCullin later in the show. But first, David Bowie. That was David Bowie with Heroes. The music, which was co-written by Bowie and Brian Eno, has been compared to a wall of sound production. In fact, Eno said that musically, the piece always sounded grand and heroic, and he had that very word, heroes, in his mind, even before Bowie wrote the lyrics. And Bowie wrote the lyrics after he saw a couple meet on a bench by the Berlin Wall. He wrote about two lovers seeking redemption just for one day. Heroes came out in 1977, and now you can hear it again on the David Bowie Legacy album, which features his very best songs. You're listening to me, Anne Bateson, bringing you Madrid Live. Now, we were talking to the legendary war photographer Don McCullin about an exhibition of his work in Madrid. Earlier in the programme, we were looking at war photos in Cambodia, and now we're going to look at photos of the starving in Africa. Don McCullin.
They were taken in 1969, I think, in a place called Biafra, which was a breakaway province in Nigeria. As the Nigerians tightened the grip on this area to regain control of the area, the Biafrans started to run out of food, and they ran out of ammunition, they ran out of everything. And you know, then what became the beginning of one story became a much bigger story when, you know, all these women and children and families were dying of starvation. So, you know, looking at these pictures, particularly the one I'm standing in front of the starving albino boy holding what's left of a French corned beef tin, licked dry, you know, waiting to die on the, you know, you can see he's bending over and he's trying to support the upper half of his body. These are the kind of pictures that come back to haunt me on a regular basis.
Do a lot of these pictures haunt you?
Not so much as the picture of this boy I'm standing in front of. I had a young family of my own, so it was a kind of double kind of punishment for me to go back and see perfectly healthy children in England, you know, refusing to eat their lunches and things. So, yeah, I mean, you can't do things like this without these images remaining. They never go away. They will never go away. If they don't, you know, appear in my mind occasionally, you know, I can open many volumes of books I've done and see these images, which I, strange enough, don't particularly care to see anymore. You could ask yourself, why have you allowed them to be on this wall in this kind of establishment? The fact is, you can never stop driving the hammer into the nail, the propaganda hammer and nail, to bring to people's attentions. If we don't, you know, when the time comes for us to make contributions to some of these tragedies around the world, we'll become too hardened to it and we won't make contributions. So I think, you know, if I can't show these images in newspapers, which they don't want anymore, you know, I'll show them anywhere.
Did you get to a point, do you think, that you could have maybe got kind of hooked on going to war to take photographs?
By the time I reached the Biafran War, I got past the druggy kind of war trips, because most people who go to war do get carried away with it. They think it's exciting. You know, what they seem to forget is that they're not paying the proper price for their excitement. It's being paid by these people. So therefore, when you get rid of that out of your system, and I managed to get rid of it pretty quickly in my life as a photographer, I got down to the serious business of looking at war with the right kind of eyes.
Okay, let's go and look at some photos of the north of England now. Okay, now we're standing in front of a picture taken in West Hartlepool in the north of England. Would you mind describing it for me?
This was in 1963. It was one of our worst winters. It was in January. The snow hadn't arrived here yet, but there was an awful lot of frost around, and I took it upon myself, because I couldn't afford a hotel, to sleep in the back of my car. For some reason, I found myself here, and I woke up and I saw these chimneys, and I had all kinds of thoughts about the chimneys. I could have been looking at probably the scenes of Birkenau in the Second World War. They reminded me of those chimneys that you read about, where people were gassed and burnt, and I thought, how strange, that smoke all drifting the same way. Of course, it wasn't the smoke of sweetness of human bodies being burnt. And then I saw that fence, and I thought, it was so poetic, the whole thing. I was disturbed by my thoughts, of course. And I thought, well, it's okay, but it really needs a person in it. And sure enough, a person came. He's wearing the typical 90s, 50s raincoat and soft peak cap from the north of England. And he basically compliments my picture. And it's a very difficult picture to print. The negative's quite thin. I didn't have the knowledge of photography that I have today. You know, when you're young, you're... Even though I still consider what I do today, I still approach it through the eyes of a student, you know, because it's about learning. It's not about experience. It's always about learning. Every time you load film into your camera, you're going to learn something new that day or that moment. So being patient and waiting for the man to to come round the corner was a very good piece of discipline. Unfortunately, I only took one picture, and I felt so sure about the picture. I jumped in my car to head south to go home to England. I only made one roll of film. I'd driven 300 miles to this place at West Hartlepool, and I thought, I'm going home, I've got the picture, which is a silly thing to do. One must never leave that quickly. I got in my car and I drove, tried to get out of the town, and I crashed my car into a bus on a roundabout. And it was drivable, and I got in that car and I drove 300 miles home. And when I processed the film, the processing could have been better, but I still had the picture. And I think, really, if I look at the picture, it's one that Henri Cartier-Bresson chose for a major exhibition that he put together. And I totally agree with him. I think it's one of my best efforts.
Okay, so all in all, looking back over your career, which photos do you feel most proud of, or which moments do you feel most proud of, maybe?
I don't really feel proud about my work. I have a pride for other reasons. The pride I've got is for dragging myself out of where I came from as a boy. At the age of 15, I couldn't read. I left school and worked on a train. That's why I know these north of England cities. What I'm really proud of was that I didn't go down the drain. I didn't become part of the criminal fraternity where I came from, which was expected of you. You were expected to do something bad and be locked up, and then you basically were anointed by the others as being one of them. I didn't want that. I'm proud of not having gone down that path. I am proud of going down another path. I'm not educated, but I've been more than rewarded with all kinds of gongs and things. They don't mean anything to me, really, but I'm proud that I've made something of my father's name, because my father died when I was 13, and I was very angry about it, because I didn't think he had a fair enough life. So I tried to make the name that he gave me mean something. It's a very strange piece of psychology, but it works for me. I feel strong about what I've done, about my life's work. I haven't been lazy, and I am not lazy to this day, and I'm still working, so it's not over yet.
That was the British war photographer Don McCullin, who was recently awarded a knighthood for his services to photography. A 3-volume retrospective of McCullin's life and work's just been published, and it's called Irreconcilable Truths. Right, that's all we've got time for. If you'd like to receive info about the next show in advance, send me an email to info@madridlive.fm. That's info@madridlive.fm. That's also the address for any comments or suggestions. And in the meantime, let's make a date for the next edition of Madrid Live with me, Anne Bateson, on Mondays at 3:30 on Radio Círculo at the Círculo de Bellas Artes in Madrid. And now, you can both stream and download recent editions of Madrid Live from the Madrid Live website, which is madridlive.fm. That's madridlive.fm.